Okay, well, why don't we get started? Let me just start the recording. Okay, welcome everyone. This is week three of the Anatomy of the Fed class with the Mises Academy, and this is the office hours session. Got about nine of you who have trickled in so far. We're just to explain the changes. So remember, I'm trying not to always make the office hours the same block of time, excuse me, from week to week, so that we can cater to some of our students are in other times. Well, they're all in different time zones, but some are on the other side of the planet from where I am, and so I'm trying to move things around a little bit. Also, we've reduced it to just an actual hour every Saturday now because I have a principal's class that starts this week, and so I'm having to do office hours for them too, so that's why it had to contract. So right now there's only 11 of you in here, so it's okay for now if you just type your questions in the chat box, and then but I do have the week three questions open. So if you have a question in there and you want to just say, hey, can you field the question I posted in the forum, just let me know. But for right now, like I said, there's only 11 of you in here. Okay, so Jan Masek says, you mentioned in the class the distinction between money supply, the curve, and money stock, the quantity. Normally, a supply curve shows a relationship between quantity and price. However, a price of money is an array of prices of all goods. It is not possible to show it as a number on an axis. Does that mean that the money supply curve is a non-existent, meaningless concept? Okay, well, that's a great question. So, I don't think it's meaningless. I mean, you're right. So let's just back up a second. So what do we mean? First of all, in case people miss Jan's, don't know what he's alluding to, I mentioned in one of the lectures, I was saying, you know, so now if we look at the money supply, and I caught myself and said, actually, the quantity of money, and then I clarified why I was doing that in this type of setting, even professional economists a lot will say, use the phrase, the supply of money. Like they might say, oh, so if the supply of money goes up, then, you know, prices go up, or, you know, if the supply of money doubles, other things equal, prices double, but there's redistribution effects, depends who gets the money for it. They'll talk like that. And probably what you're picturing in your mind is that in the beginning there's, you know, 1,000,000 ounces of gold, and then when someone says the supply of money doubles, you think, oh, now there's 2,000,000 ounces of gold. Or if it's dollar bills, you think, oh, in the beginning there's $1 trillion, then Bernanke, you know, doubles the supply of money, and now there must be $2 trillion. But that's actually a little bit of an abusive terminology, right? And for any other good or service, we wouldn't talk like that. In fact, if you took me in for principles, or if you've read my book, Lessons for the Young Economist, that's aimed at, you know, introductory principles of economics, you'll see that that's one of the things I harp on, that I really try to make sure people don't get mixed up between an increase in supply and an increase in the quantity supplied. And so if you know supply and demand curves, then, you know, the distinction means, does the whole curve move, or are you moving along the curve, right? So think of it in terms of apples. So think of it in oranges. Oranges is easier to think about for me. So there's a lot of rainfall, and it's really sunny and everything. It's great weather this season. And you could say, oh, the supply of oranges went up, meaning that it just the soil is more fertile, right? That the natural conditions for growing oranges is just better this year. It's a particularly good year. And so regardless of what the demand is, you know, people can sell more oranges more easily. And so the supply curve itself moves. But on the other hand, if the Surgeon General comes out with this report saying that the more orange juice you drink, the better sex life you have, or something like that, well, people are probably going to go buy more orange juice, and the demand for oranges will go up. And so probably more oranges will be harvested, at least next season, than this season. But it's not because the supply of oranges went up, because the supply curve would have stayed the same. It's just the fact that now the demand went up, and so that pushes up the equilibrium price. And at the higher price, farmers, you know, use more of their land to plant oranges and stuff like that. Okay, so that's So that's the distinction. So now when it comes to money, you could say, well, how does that work with money? So again, it's usually when we're thinking of like the amount of gold ounces that has been mined and is in people's pockets or vaults serving as money, and we want to say that thing doubles, it's really not that the supply of money doubles. It's better to say the quantity of money doubles. And there's, I don't want to get too technical here because I don't know what all of your background is, but I mean, technically, Rothbard does an analysis of man, economy, and state where in the very short run, like within this hour, you could draw a vertical supply curve because that's the quantity of money that's been mined or that's in existence, and then whatever the demand to hold it is, that's the quantity that has to clear the market. So there, the two sort of interrelate. But if you're talking about a more long-term thing, like over the next year, what's the supply of money economically? I mean, you can draw a supply curve, and it's, and the way to think about it to get your concept straight is not to, don't think of it in terms of the Federal Reserve and fiat money, because you're going to get all screwed up. First, think of it as a free market thing, and gold is the money. You know, gold is a physical thing, it's a commodity, and then you just say, well, what's the supply and demand for that? So the supply curve is upward sloping and the demand curve is downward sloping, but what is that vertical axis? It's not, as a Keynesian would say, the interest rate, but it's the, what's the price of money? And so as Jan was getting at, well, the price of money is its purchasing power. So to say the price of money goes up, that means it's harder to obtain money. You have to give up more to obtain money. But you say, well, what, normally we measure prices in units of money. Well, you can't measure the price of money in terms of money because that'd just be a tautology. You say, what's the price of an ounce of gold? Oh, today it's an ounce of gold. And tomorrow, what's the price of an ounce of gold? I bet you it's going to be an ounce of gold, right? You see what I'm saying? That money is price, you know, if you're trading money for money, it's going to be a one-to-one thing, but that's sort of pointless. I mean, that doesn't give you much information. So the question is, money's exchange ratio relative to all other goods and services, if you want to say what's the price, so if you want to say what's the price of a car, you say, oh, it's 3 gold ounces. But then, okay, well then what's the price of an ounce of gold? It's 1/3 of a car. We're going to see how that works. Let me just say that again. If we're using gold as the money, and so everything is denominated, its prices are all denominated in terms of ounces of gold, you might say, what's the price of that car over there? And someone might say, oh, it's 3 ounces of gold. But then if I flip it and say, oh, well, then what's the price of an ounce of gold? Well, you know, it's 1/3 of a car, or of that car, because of the exchange ratio we just determined. So another way of putting it is the owner of that car, if he wants to go buy some money, what does he have to do? Well, he has to sell something to get it, right? That's how you buy things, you trade for it. So how do you go buy money? Well, if he's got that particular car, he can go buy 3 ounces of gold with that car. He's paying with the car and buying 3 ounces of gold. I mean, it's an odd way of thinking about it because we're used to thinking that you buy stuff with money and you sell stuff for money. But in terms of the economic fundamentals, I mean, you could flip it around and think of it the other way around if you wanted to and think that what you're doing when you go out and sell things is you're buying money because you're adding to your stock of money. So we've established if the price of a car is 3 gold ounces, well, then the price of a gold ounce is 1/3 of that particular car. But you could do the same thing for every other good, right? If the price of a gumball is, or if you could get 1,000 gumballs for 1 gold ounce, then you can get a gold ounce for 1,000 gumballs. All right, I just said it backwards. I said the same thing, but you get what I'm saying. All right, so it's, yeah, right. So the price of a gold ounce is 1,000 gumballs. So what you're putting on the y-axis, if you're doing a supply and demand curve for money, is the purchasing power of money. That's what the price is. Or you can think of it in terms of labor, that if you have to work a week in order to earn an ounce of gold, then the price of an ounce of gold is a week's worth of labor. And then, so now you say, well, what does it mean if gold gets, if the price of gold goes up, Well, then that means maybe it would take you 2 weeks of labor to buy an ounce of gold. But that's just a flip side of saying that wages have gone down, measured in gold ounces. That now an hour of work only gets you 1/80th of an ounce of gold, whereas before it got you 1/40th of an ounce of gold. Okay, so so what that means is the purchasing power of money, if you believe in something called a price level, would just be the inverse of the price level. That as prices in general go up, that means the price of money goes down, right? Because just think about that, that if the prices of things quoted in gold goes up, that means a given ounce of gold buys you less. So on the flip side, that means if you have something real, like a car or a TV or labor hours to sell, you can get more gold ounces for a given quantity, or the amount you need to sell to get one gold ounce goes down, right? So again, if the purchasing power of money, whether it's fiat dollars or gold, goes down, then that means prices in general are going up. So as far as supply and demand, on the supply side, if we're thinking about a community with gold, well, that's just like the gold miners. Like, where's new gold come from? Well, the people who own the gold mines, right? And they have to spend actual, you know, resources hiring workers and buying mining equipment, and they got to pay for to keep the tracks in good repair, to have the cars go in and out of the mine and all that kind of stuff, right? So in that sort of world, if the purchasing power of money goes up, then they're going to want to, then the quantity of gold produced is going to go up, right? So what that means, again, is if the prices of everything else quoted in gold go down, the owners of gold mines are going to have the incentive to dig up more gold, right? Because now, because on the margin, right, they're gonna keep mining gold until the point at which to bring one more ounce of gold to the surface would cost them at least or more than an ounce of gold in factors on the margin, right? And it gets a little tricky because they have to deal with the gold that's still underground, and if gold is going to go up in value, you know, they can reap that capital gain if it's still sitting in the ground next year. So you got to do the analysis properly. But all things considered, it's still true that they will continue. They will mine more and more gold until the point at which bringing up one more ounce today will cost them more than an ounce. But again, part of that cost could be if they lose out on a capital gain from letting the gold sit in the ground over time, if they think gold prices are going to go up over time. All right, so that's easy enough to think about. It's just tricky if gold is the money, because then the issue isn't, oh, it cost me $1,000 to dig up an ounce of gold and gold's selling for $1,300 an ounce, so I made a profit. No, if gold is the money, there's not a dollar price you're putting on gold. It's just everything is quoted in ounces of gold. And so an ounce of gold has the purchasing power of an ounce of gold, but you need to say, you know, oh, I can hire the workers to dig up that ounce of gold now for a half an ounce of gold, whereas last week I would have had to pay them an ounce of gold. And so since gold's purchasing power went up 100%, and so everything, you know, their workers' wages got cut in half, now all of a sudden it makes a ton of sense for me to bring those workers in, pay them collectively a half an ounce of gold, and then with their labor they bring me an ounce of gold to the surface. See, I've made a half an ounce of gold profit. Okay, so you can meaningfully talk about the supply of money in that kind of environment, because I mean you sort of have to, otherwise as an economist you would be at a loss. How could you explain how much money is produced in that sort of environment? But you're right, Jan, it is a little bit weird, because it's not the one of the functions that money serves is it gives us a common denominator, that every price can be expressed in terms of that good or service's exchange ratio with the money commodity. And so then the one commodity for which that's not particularly useful is the money commodity, since it's always just one-to-one. And so if you want to talk about, well, what's its price, there's no one number you can point to. It's really like a vector saying, well, its exchange ratio against all these other prices. So in practice, probably what's true to say is that each potential producer of gold cares about a certain combination of or certain bundle of the prices. But then arbitragers make sure that, you know, there's no gaping discrepancies where gold is you know, can buy a lot of one thing and a little bit of another. Like, they make sure all that stuff gets ironed out in equilibrium. So it is true that it's a little bit fuzzier to talk about the purchasing power of money when you try to define it precisely. But I mean, you could say the same thing just on a lesser scale. You say, oh, what's the price of oil? Well, there is no price of oil. There's all kinds of different grades of oil, and you know, there's light sweet crude, and there's, you know, the oil that comes from South America is physically different from the oil that comes from Saudi Arabia. It's actually economically different too. I mean, it's not just that a chemist could spot the difference, but the consumers don't care. No, I mean, you need your refinery to be configured differently depending on where the crude is coming from. All right, so even when we say what's the price of oil, I mean, that's actually not just one single number. You'd have to get a little bit more specific. So, I mean, it's obviously that is way less problematic than saying what's the price of money. But my point is just, if you don't have a problem in principle talking about the price of oil, you know, you kind of make the same simplifications when you want to talk conceptually what's the price of money. Okay, so for those of you who trickled in here, right now there's only about 13 of you signed in, so I think it's fine if we just do the questions in the chat box, unless it starts getting out of hand. Okay, Benjamin says, blood on Bernanke's hands, riots in Egypt over food prices, unemployment. This is a headline from top-tier economic blogger Mish Sedlock. Is it true that Fed money printing is resulting in hot money pushing up agriculture prices? And do you still think that the Congress critters can kick the can down the road for 10 to 15 more years? It's tricky. Certainly, I think that what Bernanke has been doing is at least partially responsible for soaring commodity prices. And the reason I'm saying it's tricky is it's, like, let's take oil, because I work on energy issues, so I'm more familiar with that. The way they compute these numbers, I mean, the quantity demanded of oil in the world right now is at an all-time high. And it has been for the last at least year, let's say. Okay, so it dipped. Did it dip? The rate of increase slowed during the recession. I'm not even sure off the top of my head if the quantity demanded of oil went down during the recession. It may have for a brief period. But my point is just, if you look at the number of barrels of oil that's being physically consumed per day on planet Earth, that's higher now than it was in 2008. And so it's probably true that oil prices would be high even if it weren't for Bernanke's shenanigans. And because because the way it works is, at any given time, there's a certain amount of crude oil in inventories, right? And so, in other words, it's not the oil they extract and pump. I mean, that goes into inventories, and then they draw down from inventories when they're going through refinery and stuff like that, and using up the oil in various ways. And so the point is just, for the last 7 or 8 years, that buffer has been really thin, so that if just one major oil producing place went down, you know, the world price of oil has to shoot up really sharply, because they can't run out of the buffer, if you get what I'm saying. That the market price has to respond to make sure it knocks the quantity demanded down if there happens to be a supply interruption. And so the market's doing exactly what you would want. If the world demand for oil on a daily basis is creeping up, and it sometimes even overshoots how much is physically being extracted per day, well, something's got to give, right? That can't last very long, because otherwise we're going to, the inventories will get all depleted, and then there's just going to be a crash that some people physically aren't going to get the oil they need. So what does the market price do? I said, well, the market price shoots up. And that's partly what was happening, I think, in, what was that, 2008. If you remember, going into the summer of 2008, oil went way up, and it was absurd. And a lot of people were saying, oh, that's because of speculators. But, I mean, yeah, but what are the speculators speculating about? And looking at various physical things, like there wasn't, as far as I could determine, a huge accumulation of oil and inventories, which would be the hallmark of a speculative bubble. Instead, what you saw was that even though oil production was at all-time highs, meaning how many barrels of oil were being extracted and delivered per day, the amount that the world was using was rising even more. And so there was still that gap. So the oil quantity supplied was increasing to narrow the gap, but the gap was still there. There was still a deficit all through that period when the price of oil was rising. So, you know, even if you put aside all the issues of fiat money and everything and just said, well, how would the market price, what would you want the market price to do with that situation? Well, you'd want it to keep going up because it's got to, you know, oh my gosh, we really have to get quantity supplied and demand in sync or else we're going to run out of oil. Someone's going to have a crash. So this is a long way of saying, just looking at if you didn't know anything about monetary policy and you were just looking at the physical rates of consumption and production, you might think that, yeah, oil right now is where it should be. So, and part of the problem with all this stuff is the numbers that we use for that kind of, like to say, what's the quantity of oil consumed per day on planet Earth? Well, I don't know how much to trust that number. I trust a number that says, how much oil does this particular refinery in Kansas use per day? Because I imagine that the people running that refinery know, and that's an actual number they have, and you know the statistics could be fairly accurate. But to talk about the world as a whole, well, come on. I mean, there's got to be a lot of guessing going on with that kind of number. So if the numbers were accurate, then you would think that maybe it's not so much about monetary policy, but again, it's possible that oil is being taken and put into storage somewhere for people to use it as an inflation hedge, and yet the people counting those purchases say, oh, that's demand for oil, meaning consumption, when really it's being held. So it's hard to rely on those numbers. But anyways, my point is just the recession that is being experienced in the United States and in Europe and on other so-called advanced Western countries, that's not happening all over the world, right? There are a lot of places where their economies are booming and they have high price inflation. And it's really hard to disentangle all these effects. So yeah, to answer your question, my gut tells me that, yeah, there has to be something to the case that the fact that Bernanke's printed up all this money and then commodity prices are zooming up, that makes perfect sense, and I think that there is something to be said there. But on the other hand, like I say, it's with all this stuff, there's a lot of different factors going on, and it's true that they are passing, for the last few years, they've been doing things like in Southeast Asia, signing tariff reduction agreements with each other and, you know, allowing people to international investors to have more property rights and things. So even if monetary policy around the world were great, I would have expected there to be booming growth in some of these places that traditionally their people didn't have a lot of freedom, and now the chains are being lifted. So you would think, holy cow, these, you know, there's hundreds of millions of people now that are being freed up. And so you would imagine that their demand for food and other stuff is going to skyrocket. And so you would think prices would respond to that. So it's hard to disentangle all that stuff. Probably in reality, it's probably a combination of all those things. It's probably you've got like the legitimate reasons for resources to get channeled to those countries, but then coupled with what Bernanke's doing, it sort of feeds on itself. That on the one hand, he's providing the fuel, if you will, to get those that price inflationary spiral going, and also the reason speculators and other people aren't so much worried about a bubble is that they're going to say, oh, well, no, but there's legitimate fundamental reasons for prices to be rising so much. Just like during the housing bubble years, where I do think for sure it was monetary policy that fueled a lot of that, people would try to explain it away by pointing to things like, well, no, you know, Clinton revised the tax treatment in the late 90s, and so, you know, you wouldn't have a capital gains tax on your first residence up to a certain cutoff. So, I mean, if you can come up with, if you're trying to explain why a certain price increase isn't just because of monetary inflation, if you can come up with some other explanation, then that sort of keeps it going, because then more people are relieved and they say, okay, then it makes sense the prices are going up so high. Okay. And your other part of your question was, do you still think that the Congress critters can kick the can down the road for 10 to 15 more years? No, and I've never thought that, so I don't know if by saying do you still think, I mean I've been surprised it's lasted this long, to be honest with you. So I think there's going to be a few days of reckoning, but I think one big thing is going to be, what are the federal government or the Fed going to do about all these states that are in trouble? Because the thing is, a lot of these states right now, and even municipalities, are really in a serious debt situation, and they're going to, if it persists, they're just going to have to start mass layoffs, you know, cutting school budgets and things that, I think there was a city in Alabama that just stopped making its pension payments to its retired employees. I mean, stuff like that, which 5 years ago would have been inconceivable, but now it's happening because they just don't have any money. So stuff like that, it'll be interesting to see if the Fed, for example, if the Fed comes in and just bails out California, if Bernanke just creates $100 billion and gives it to California, you know, uses it to buy bonds issued by the state of California, so that they can continue to borrow without their interest rates skyrocketing, then I think a lot of people are going to say, whoa, that's not monetary policy. That is just bailing people out and printing money to do it. And that's just monetizing the debt. I mean, even though that's what the Fed has been doing for the last 2 years anyway, so far Bernanke has been able to convince most people that no, it's just a coincidence that I'm creating $1 trillion and giving it to the world's richest bankers. I'm not bailing them out. I'm just doing this to shore up the financial system. And we have to expand aggregate demand and all that kind of stuff. So I think if they start bailing out state governments, with the Fed in particular, because if Congress does it, it just kind of looks like a shell game. But when the Fed does it, I think people will start to realize, wait a minute, they're just printing up dollars to bail out their buddies. That's a little bit weird. And that, I think, would be, like, once that kind of thing happens, I think everyone's going to really know deep down the U.S. is not going to get out of this. They're ultimately just going to print their way out of this, and the dollar's going to just sink even further. So when is all that going to happen? I don't know, but I don't think it's going to take 10 years, put it that way. For one thing, I don't know if you guys have seen this, but like the Congressional Budget Office, they have these scary looking charts showing the projection of deficits over the next 10 to 15 years. In those scenarios, they are assuming that we've already turned the corner on this recession. They assume that we're in a recovery phase right now. And yeah, it's a bit sluggish for some reason. We don't know exactly why. But that unemployment is going to continue to trend downward. And, you know, we're just going to, it's a sluggish recovery, but we've turned the corner. And if instead of that scenario, if next year interest rates skyrocket and the stock market crashes again and the housing market crashes again and unemployment goes up to 12%, then all the bets are off. I mean, tax revenues are going to be much lower than those scenarios predict. Payments out are going to be higher because there's, you know, more people on food stamps and unemployment benefits, and more people will be retiring earlier and then trying to collect their Social Security. So it all kind of feeds on itself, that when the economy starts, if the economy really did recover, we could get through this. That, you know, that yeah, they could, the deficit could shrink over time because of all those reasons. Tax revenues would be rising, and the emergency assistance would be going down, and people would be working longer and paying into Social Security for a few more years before they start taking checks out. So those things are all plugged into these scenarios that already show the debt continuing to rise as a fraction of GDP for a while. So if instead of that scenario, it's what I think is going to happen, I mean, it's going to be pretty bad pretty quickly. Okay. Yes, I got a haircut, Giuseppe. Okay, so Jan says, but what number do I put on the vertical axis when there's an infinite number of prices of gold? Well, you don't. Okay, so sorry, I misunderstood what you were asking. You can't put a number on there because there's... you're right. Well, you said, what's the purchasing power? You could pick some arbitrary way of coming up with a number. Like, you could say, take a basket of commodities and then say, how many ounces of gold would it take to buy that basket? And then do the inverse of that. You'd say, how many baskets of these commodities could I buy with an ounce of gold? And that would be the price, the purchasing power of gold. And you could put that in there, but you're right, that would be arbitrary. But like I said, I'm just trying to warn you that it's not... Don't think, okay, so our tools of supply and demand don't work really for gold, but they work for everything else. Because also you could say, well, how do you explain the price of cars? You say, oh, well, what's the price of a car? What was the price of a car last month? Well, you don't mean the price of a car, because there's all kinds of cars, right? But even if you picked a particular car and say, okay, I'm talking about a Ford Taurus this year with this many miles and da-da-da-da-da-da, well, there's no one price, even over the course of a month. Right, even if you're talking about new cars at the various dealerships, you know, some dealers would give more incentives to people, like give them better financing or throw in whatever, a car wash. Who knows what they do? I don't even know what I haven't bought a car in a while. Right, so there's all kinds of stuff they can do so that even if the official price is the same at two dealerships, the actual price to the consumer is going to be different. So, you know, you could say with equal validity, well, how do I know what price to put on the y-axis if I want to do a supply and demand explanation for the car market? And just to drive home that point, you might be thinking, no, but come on, I mean, for one particular transaction, I do know what the car price was. That's a well-defined concept. It's how many dollar bills or how many ounces of gold changed hands for the thing. Okay, but then you can say the same thing for gold. For any particular transaction, you know exactly what the price of gold was. It was whatever was on the other side of that transaction. So, like I say, I'm not trying to poo-poo your concerns. You're right, and actually Mises, one of his big points is in the theory of money and credit is that there's really no such thing as the price level. Or when you talk about the purchasing power of money, there's no objective way to define that without being arbitrary. That one economist could have his price index and another economist could have his price index, and then one of them says, oh, prices went up 3.7% last year, and the other guy says, no, prices only went up 2.8%, and it's not like one person's right and one person's wrong. That they both could, you know, with equal plausibility say that they have a good price index and they ran the numbers right, and so one person's CPI inflation is one number and the other guy's is a different number. And it's not like saying what's the charge on an electron or how many inches of rainfall did this particular city have last year, where in principle that's a well-defined concept and different scientists might come up with different numbers, but at least one of them must be wrong. Whereas here, when you're trying to measure price inflation, Mises' point was that's not just some number that actually exists and it's our job to find it, that we kind of have to just define what do we mean by that term, and we could have different definitions. Okay. Going along with that, Jan says, but Austrians don't believe in the price level, do they? Yes and no. So they have to, in the sense conceptually, you have to talk about the purchasing power of money if you want to use a supply and demand analysis to explain the market for money. And there, I mean the market to supply and hold money. I don't mean, like, money market funds. And but you're also right that Austrians try to get away from talking about the price level because that obliterates all of the sectoral distinctions, so that in things that we call Cantillon effects. So if Austrians don't like this kind of analysis, oh, the Fed doubled the quantity of money, and so the price level doubled. Austrians typically don't like that because they want to say, no, you're ignoring the fact that the money comes in a certain channel and then particular prices start going up, and it's more of a rippling effect. And so I think some Austrians use the phrase the price web instead of the price level to show that, no, there's a bunch of different nodes and some of them can move up and down, and so that it's... Mises talks about all this stuff, and he says, look, there's a general sense in which we can say unambiguously prices went way up in interwar Germany, or in our times, nobody's going to be stupid and say, hey, I don't know if prices went up in Zimbabwe because there's no such thing as the price level. I mean, come on, we know prices in general went way up in Zimbabwe, but it's true, it's hard, you know, if you want to say, did they go up by a quadrillion percent, or do they only go up by 999 trillion percent, well, then you don't know. It's kind of arbitrary, but you can distinguish between periods of massive price inflation and periods where money generally held its purchasing power. But to get really specific and quantitative, then you start having to get arbitrary. Okay, Giuseppe says, I have had it said to me that we would need government to invest in medical research because it is very high risk and the returns are very far down the road. As such, the private sector would not invest in it. What do you think? Well, the way I handle these things is that it's just two-pronged. So first of all, the government only gets its funds from the private sector, right? So it's not like... So I think people are wrong when they say... Because I've heard stuff like, oh, well, you know, the private sector couldn't have afforded to go to the moon, so that's why we needed the government to do it. But no, it's not like the government has its own resources sitting somewhere and it kicks in. No, I mean, anything the government does, it took from the private sector. And any resources that were used to build the, you know, Apollo rockets and to send people and all the research and everything that went into it, I mean, those resources came from the economy. So they physically existed. We just showed it's technologically possible to do it. And so if you say, so really what it comes down to, and to go back to your medical example, you know, the medical research, if it's true that the private sector wouldn't do something, well, then you have to ask, well, why not? So that's the thing. A lot of people don't understand what the social function of profits and losses are. That when a business is doing something that's unprofitable, there's a prima facie case to be made that's a waste of resources. That's what it means. That's what the market's red flag saying, whoa, 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 this particular enterprise is using scarce resources in a bad way, that these resources ought to be redirected and going into doing something else. And how do you know that? Well, because the reason so what does it mean when you're suffering a loss if it's unprofitable for an enterprise to do something? It means that the amount of money that you're getting from consumers for whatever it is that you're producing is not enough to cover the prices you have to pay for the resources that you use up. But then you have to ask, well, wait a minute, why are those resources so expensive? Well, it's because other firms in the economy are paying high prices for those resources, bidding up their price, because those other firms, which are profitable, are making stuff with those resources that their consumers are willing to pay enough for so that those firms can stay in business. And so in the grand scheme, if any particular firm is unprofitable, it means it's trying to draw resources away from other firms to make stuff that consumers don't want to spend as much money on as consumers want to spend in other areas using those same resources. And that's what it means when you're unprofitable. So to the extent that you think consumers, through their spending decisions, ought to be the ones ultimately steering what gets made in a market economy, well, then the answer to your question, Giuseppe, is to say, well, if private people wouldn't engage in that research, it's because it's not a good use of resources. There are better uses for those resources. And so when you say, oh no, but it's really high risk and down the road, you say, exactly, that's why we shouldn't do it. It's too risky. In other words, it might not pay off, so you might have squandered those resources for nothing. Or even if it does pay off, the results, you know, that cancer treatment's not going to appear for 30 years. And given people's preferences right now, they don't want to wait 30 years. They would rather have, dental implants next year, or they would rather take their kids to Disney World next year rather than wait 30 years for a potential cancer cure. And people could say, oh, well, that's the consumers are stupid. Well, okay, but then let's just be clear that what you're doing is you're being a paternalist. You're saying, I know better how resources should be invested. I can spend people's money better than they can. And let's at least be upfront about what you're doing. But to just say, oh, well, the market doesn't they make it sound like it's this arbitrary mechanism. Well, no, the reason the market's doing that is because people have preferences for certain things. So, I mean, you could just exaggerate, Giuseppe, if you wanted to, if you're arguing with somebody, and you could just say, well, suppose we could spend $1 trillion in order to fund research that had a 1% chance of curing cancer, but it wouldn't be ready for 200 years. Should we spend $1 trillion for that 1% chance of curing cancer in 200 years? And most people, I'm hoping, would say no, because you could take $1 trillion right now and do a lot of good with that. Like, even if you just wanted to send malaria treatments and mosquito nets and stuff to people in Africa, and to, you know, send baby milk formula or whatever to people in China, you could do a lot with $1 trillion rather than dump it into this thing that only had a 1% chance of curing cancer in 200 years. All right, so I think that's maybe the way to do it if you're actually debating somebody, is set up this really ridiculous extreme example to get them to see at some point even they might agree, oh yeah, you wouldn't want that research being funded right now because it's just too expensive and too tenuous. And then once you at least concede that possibility, now you're just arguing about numbers. And so now you're just saying, okay, now you get the idea, you get the concept that it is conceivable certain research would be too risky or the benefits would be too distant to make it worthwhile to fund. And so now we're just arguing numbers. What if instead of that, you know, this particular project, the private sector won't develop it and you want the government to do it? Well, why do you think the private sector is wrong about this? Because, you know, the answer can't just be, oh, well, the private sector doesn't handle risk and distance properly, because, you know, we already just showed cases where that would be right. Okay, Matteo says, from an Austrian viewpoint, does silver play a role in terms of being a medium of exchange with gold? Also, are there any societies that have adopted the Austrian theories that we can study to see what the results were? Okay, so from an Austrian viewpoint, it's not that Austrian economists say gold ought to be money. I mean, Austrian economics just studies the nature of money per se and what is a money, and then you could also explain as more as historians who know economics, why it was that traditionally market economies tended to adopt gold and silver as their monies. But it's not that Austrian economics per se says gold ought to be the money. It just says what money is. It's a commonly accepted medium of exchange, and then we can explain qualities that people in the real world tend to value in a money. So like its ease of divisibility, its durability, its purchasing power, being convenient, for the types of transactions people want to use it for. And then you can explain and after the fact why it was that people probably gravitated towards gold and silver as opposed to cows or, you know, rubies or emeralds or something like that. But so it's not that Austrians say gold per se. Now, the reason nowadays we talk a lot about the gold standard and things, so it's part of that is just we predict that if the government weren't involved, the market would return to using gold as the money. But it's, again, it's not that Austrian economics per se has that plugged into it. And also because most people are familiar with the term gold standard. And so if you're talking politically and trying to get people to see how things could be different from how they are now, it seems less radical to say we should just go back to the way it was before 1933 as opposed to saying, no, let's just totally get rid of the money, government's involvement altogether, and let anything happen and the market will figure it out. A lot of people, that scares them. And so that's, I think, partly why rhetorically I and other Austrians will focus more on going back to gold. Again, not because in our ideal system the government's going to go around telling you what the money should be. So anyway, as far as gold and silver, I think historically what happened was that they were often, it would vacillate between the two. So Mises talks about this in the theory of money and credit. And I think part of it is that for small transactions, silver was more convenient, and for bigger transactions, gold was more convenient. And, you know, so if you wanted to buy something that was fairly inexpensive in the store, you know, you go to the general store and you want to get some cider or whatever, or get some ropes for your horses. I'm just making stuff up. I don't know exactly what they did back then, but if all you had was gold, I mean, if you bought something kind of small, I mean, you'd have to be giving them a really dinky amount of gold, and so it was just more convenient. Like instead of having a coin that had just a tiny little fraction of gold in it and the rest was base metal, it would be easier to have coins that were made out of silver because silver was less valuable per ounce than gold was. All right, so that's the idea. But then what happened is governments tried to enforce what was called a bimetallic standard, and they wanted to say, okay, well, this is kind of confusing for people. Is gold the money? Is silver the money? So they try to say, well, let's just codify it and say, any price of anything that's priced in terms of silver, you can buy it with gold at this exchange ratio, and then vice versa, anything that's being priced in gold, you can buy with silver at the same exchange ratio between gold and silver. And so they did that, thinking that would ease, you know, that would make it more convenient for people, because now if you had a bunch of silver and you saw a merchant trying to sell something in gold, you wouldn't have to quibble over the exchange rate. Like, you knew, oh, gold and silver had this fixed exchange ratio. But what happened, of course, is Gresham's law kicked in, and then when the market exchange ratio of gold for silver went one way, even though the government was making it, you know, like legal tender, like you had to, the merchant had to accept either gold or silver at that exchange ratio, well, then people would just do all their purchases in silver if silver was the overvalued money at that time, and everyone would hoard gold. But then, because of the vagaries of mining and so forth, if the market price of silver happened to increase, so that according to the official exchange ratio, now silver was undervalued, then people would just do all their purchases in gold, and everybody would hoard silver. So Mises said, instead of codifying the bimetallic standard, instead it went to an alternating standard, where sometimes it was gold, and then sometimes everyone used silver, and then sometimes they used gold. So to answer your question, I don't know. In terms of Austrian theory, it's agnostic about it. It's just saying people will do what they want to do, and there could be multiple monies in existence at one time. Right? Because to be a money just means it's a commonly accepted medium of exchange. To be a money, it doesn't need to be the only commonly accepted medium of exchange. It just means something that whenever you want to buy something, everyone in the community is going to be willing to accept that. And so it's we can imagine that gold and silver simultaneously in a given group of people are both monies, so that any store you go into, even if the guy quotes prices in terms of gold, you could say, well, all I have is a bunch of silver coins. And then he said, oh, okay, well, here's my policy, and he'll point at a sign saying, on today's purchases, if you want to convert my gold price stickers into silver, this is the exchange ratio I'll honor for that. And that's how you could do it. And that, in case that sounds weird or whatever, I mean, that's what they do in foreign countries. Like, if you go to Mexico, or at least this was true when I went a few years ago, people would have their prices in terms of the Mexican currency, typically. But if you had actual dollar bills, you could pay with them, and you would get different exchange rates depending on which store you were in. And then sometimes, too, if you went into a fancy restaurant that was catering to Americans, their menu might even be calibrated in terms of U.S. dollars. All right, so, and then I think some places really tried to take advantage of dumb foreigners, that they would just, it wouldn't be obvious which one they were pricing it in. And then they could tell, like if you went into a jewelry store, they might say something they might just say, yeah, that's $15. And then you would say, well, Mexican or American. And I think, like, they would size you up and figure out, is this moron going to pay me five times as much as the next guy? And they might tell you one or the other. So that you do have that kind of system in some places already with fiat currencies. And it's just, I think that's what would happen with gold and silver. So would it, I mean, there is a problem with that it's less convenient, right? The virtue of having a money in the first place, you'll lose out on that the more monies there are. Okay, because that's part of what the whole point was, that if you're a merchant, to have everything in terms of a common denominator, and so it gets a little bit trickier just in terms of your accounting if people are paying you with gold or silver. And then, in particular, like, what if there were 10 monies in a certain community? Well, after a while, if everything were a money, then you'd be back to not having money at all. And so Mises said that there was a certain tension there, and that's partly why governments at some point decided just to go for gold and to wipe out silver as being a money, to demonetize silver. But in the voluntary marketplace, would that happen? We don't know. Okay, we got about 7 minutes left. And Matteo, as far as your thing about, are there any societies that have adopted the Austrian theories? I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, there's been no society that's been completely Rothbardian, if that's what you mean. But as far as, like, monetary stuff, I mean, historically, certainly, there was a lot more monetary freedom in the 1800s. And you can study the way the classical gold standard worked. I mean, that wasn't a complete laissez-faire thing. And you can certainly look at... you can try to look at the effects of different... Well, let me put it this way. George Selgin has done a lot of great work on private mints. And so, like, what kind of coins are produced when that's just a normal thing that markets or that businesses do, is they make the money. That they take the gold and silver and then strike coins with it. And he has I saw this fantastic presentation he did at the Mises Institute one time, going through that and just showing you pictures of the coins that the private mints made compared to the coins that the government monopoly mint made. And, it wasn't a monopoly. The government-privileged mint made. And you could just tell, like, the private coins were just better coins. And, the people preferred them. So, I mean, you have stuff like that. And then in terms of the free banking position, there's people will argue that there was a relative period of laissez-faire in the banking system, and then how did banks operate back then. I haven't read that literature too much, and I know, like, Rothbard objects to characterizing that period is laissez-faire. But for sure, in terms of money and banking, there are periods where the government was a lot less involved than it is now, and Austrians have made the case that things were a lot better back then. In terms of the purchasing power of money being more stable, and the economy being, the business cycle not being as severe. Okay. Eric Broden says, on the yield curve, the blue line spikes up above the red at around 1965 to 66 without a recession following. Was something different those years that made this happen? Yeah, that's a good catch. So what Eric's talking about in the last lecture, remember, I was saying how the Austrian theory of the business cycle can explain this apparent ability of the yield curve to predict recessions, meaning every time the yield curve inverts, there's typically a recession that follows. And Eric is saying, wait a minute, the yield curve inverted in 65 and 66, and yet there wasn't a recession. So what was going on there? Well, what happened is there was a real slowdown in economic activity, I think, in 67. But it didn't technically qualify as a recession, so they didn't put a gray bar there. But if you go look at the GDP data and the unemployment data, it was like a near miss, if you get what I'm saying. So so there is that issue. Okay. Giuseppe says, do you recommend a book on risk or insurance? Well, I mean, I have a chapter on insurance if you just want a really quick introduction in how privatized banking really works. So if you want that, let me see if I can get you the URL of that. Alright, well, that's coming up now. Of course, my browser's frozen. So there I give you just a basic explanation of what insurance does and how risk is involved there. But as far as, I mean, if you want more than that, Hans Hoppe has something on the nature of risk from a Misesian viewpoint. I don't know. I mean, that gets kind of almost philosophical. All right, so there's the PDF of that, Giuseppe, if you want. You just look at the table of contents, you'll be able to see what chapter I'm talking about. Because Mises makes a distinction between case probability and class probability. I don't want to get into it right now because it's too far afield, but Hoppe has an essay on that. It's got the word risk in the title. I'm not going to be able to come up with it off the top of my head. But you could read that to see from a sort of Misesian point. The idea is some events are insurable and some aren't. That's what they're talking about. So I'm not agreeing with it or disagreeing with it. I'm just saying that that's out there if you want something that is a treatment of risk and insurance from a Misesian viewpoint. But the thing I just sent you is more of a standard, just economist explanation of what insurance is and how it works. Okay, we got about one more minute, and then I got to cut it off because I do have that other office hour soon. So, let's see. Yeah, Benjamin's talking about a good one. The Fed decided last week to change its accounting rules and guaranteeing its assets can never decline. Do you think they are preparing for QE 3, 4, 5 to infinity, or are they preparing for a rise in interest rates? Okay, and I skipped your part of your question, Benjamin, because I just want to rephrase my own words. So, and also, the Fed didn't do it last week, Benjamin. The Fed announced it in a release, I think, on January 6th. But they buried it in the technical, you know, they didn't have this huge, you know, hey, press release, guess what, everybody, we changed the rule. No, they just buried it. They made it look like it was a little, you know, technical thing, like they tweaked the assumptions in the CPI or something, as opposed to, holy cow, you're doing what? So what they're doing, for those of you who didn't hear this, is if remember when we were doing the balance sheet accounting, if there's a if the IOUs on your assets side, if the market value of those things go down, then while your liabilities haven't changed, well then the cap the shareholder equity takes a hit, right? Because the two sides of the balance sheet have to go down. If your assets go down but your liabilities are the same, well, the right-hand side of the balance sheet, that total has to go down so the two numbers match. So the only thing that can give is the shareholder equity goes down. And so what the Fed did is they made this announcement on January 6th, I believe, was the exact release date, saying, okay, from now on, and the other thing you need to know is if you're holding a bunch of bonds, what could make their market value go down? It would be if interest rates go up. All right, so it's, if you're, and it's, since we're kind of out of time here, I don't want to get into that if you don't know why that works, but the price of a bond and in the yield on the bond move in opposite directions. So it doesn't mean that, so that the Fed's sitting on a bunch of treasury debt. And so if the interest rates on treasuries go up, people who are currently sitting on treasuries, their price goes down. They still might get paid those interest payments and principal repayment. It doesn't mean that Uncle Sam defaulted just because interest rates go up. But what it means is if the Fed wanted to sell those bonds to somebody else in the meantime, they would get less money for it right now than they would have before interest rates went up. Because what a bond is, it's an asset entitling you to a stream of dollar payments. And so when interest rates go up, you discount those future streams of dollars more heavily. And so the present value of that stream of dollars now is lower if the interest rate's higher. Okay? So the point is, in terms of the Fed's balance sheet and its asset side, right now it's got hundreds of billions of treasuries. I just looked up the exact number the other day. I can't remember it off the top of my head now. It may even be over a trillion. I'm blanking out on the number. Okay, so the point is they're sitting on a ton of bonds issued by Uncle Sam. So if the interest rate goes up, those bonds take a huge hit. Normally, for normal business, you'd say, oh, well, your shareholder equity went down. And so that's why people were worried, myself included. Well, if interest rates spike with all this quantitative easing, the Fed is sitting on a huge, huge portfolio of bonds, they might become insolvent, right? In other words, if they take such, you know, when interest rates go up, if the Fed, because it's sitting on so many bonds and their value goes down a certain amount, if that drop is bigger than what the Fed's equity is on the balance sheet, then technically the Fed is bankrupt. It's insolvent. And, you know, normally you'd have to shut that down and pay off the creditors. Oop, okay, I think I'm back. Right? So, so you see the point. So, therefore, the Fed, when it made this announcement, it said the rule change was. It said, okay, if we take a capital loss or if the value of our bonds goes down, we're not going to record that on our books as a hit to our capital or as a reduction in our shareholder equity. What we're going to do is we're going to list that as a negative liability or a liability of the treasury. And that's the way we're going to balance the books. So there's a lot. So I think they're saying there's a loss on the left side of their balance sheet. You know, the assets went down, and I guess I'd have to go read the exact language of what they're doing, but I think they're saying on the right side, they would just say, you know, U.S. Treasury negative $2 billion. And so when you add up, you know, their liabilities and the Treasury's negative thing and then their equity, that number would go down by the amount listed the Treasury. Because what the Fed does, when they have excess earnings, they remit that to the Treasury. And so that's what they're saying they would do, is they would say, instead of us recording it as our loss, we're just going to say, you know, there's this huge negative or this huge debt that now the Treasury owes us because of this loss on our bond portfolio. And so we're going to work that number off. So when we have our excess earnings that normally we would have given to the Treasury, you know, we'll still send it to them, but cycle around and reduce how much the Treasury owes us and whittle down that negative number. Okay, so anyway, it just smoke and mirrors to say the Fed right now, it's impossible for them to go bankrupt. They cannot become insolvent by definition now, no matter what happens. Even if every asset on their book goes to zero tomorrow, the Fed will not be insolvent in terms of the accounting that they've decided to do. So that's kind of a freaky thing. So what Benjamin was saying is, why do I think they did that? And I think you're right on both counts, Benjamin. I think because they are planning on buying ever more government bonds because they realize that's their only solution now, that every time they hit a hiccup in the road, they buy themselves a few more months by saying, oh, we're going to buy another $600 billion bonds. And they also know at some point interest rates are going to start rising, and it's possible we're going to start taking huge hits on our bond portfolio at that point. And so we want to get things set up right now so that there's going to be no question that we get to continue to operate. Because that's the thing. I mean, there's no reason for the Fed to have to shut down, right? A normal business, if you hit liquidity problems, or especially if you're insolvent, what that means is you owe people more money than people owe you, all right? That you just don't have enough assets to satisfy all your creditors. And so that's why you get shut down, because it's like, well, you know, game over, and we got to pay them off, and then somebody else has to use that capital. Whereas the Fed, yeah, it has liabilities, but they're just Federal Reserve notes. So somebody shows up with a $100 bill and says, hey, you owe me $100. The Fed's going to say, okay, I'll give you 520s for it, right? It's which the Fed can create. So it's not like there's any actual constraint on the Fed's day-to-day operations, even if it does become insolvent. But again, it's just, in my article on this, I was saying, I think they don't want that to happen, because that might wake people up to realize the Fed is not a normal business, that the Fed is doing something fishy. It's creating money out of thin air. Because any normal business, if you become insolvent, you have to get shut down. Even a commercial bank, if it becomes insolvent, you know, the FDIC comes in and shuts them down and takes them over. And so I think the people running the Fed realized, we cannot become insolvent, because it would just be a public relations disaster. And so they did this, put this thing in place. So now, as they continue to grow their bond portfolio, and if interest rates spike, there's going to be no question. And then they're going to say, no, we're not insolvent, because we that rule change. Just the Treasury is in the hole $300 billion, but it'll have to work its way out of that over the next few decades. Okay, well, I got to stop at this point. So thanks, guys. Remember that if you're doing it for credit, you got to take the quiz by tomorrow night. See you later.